Chapter 12. No Man's Land. On the old rutted gravel road by the grassy bank, the young men squeezed aboard the buses, carrying only their knapsacks and their hopes for a better year. The buses followed the road as it crossed a rolling country covered with soft yellowing grass, dotted here and there with the occasional banyan or sisu. There were creeks bluer than any sky, their waters braided over gravel bars. There were also fruit farms, but after a hard and dry summer here in Lagman province, the trees stood bare. For the farmers on the bus, there had been no work to be found here. They rode on through the Hindu Kush, following the rapids of Kabul River alongside sheer cliffs dropping almost 1,000 feet, and on to the shallow hills of Kabul. Looking through the window, the men could see low-slung concrete buildings and glimmering wedding halls. But without access, there was no hope of work here either. So they switched buses and headed south into the bare country of Wardak. With the roadside craters and unpredictable checkpoints, each trip through Wardak was a perverse lottery. The men said their prayers. It was past dawn when they pulled into Kandahar City and switched buses again. From here it would be a good 15 hours to the Iranian border, to the traffickers who would arrange their crossing and help them find work. The two new buses took the highway west into the deserts of Maiwan district. It was open country for miles around, not a building or shack in sight. Then some armed men ran onto the road ahead. Thinking fast, the driver of the first bus accelerated. Before the gunmen could close ranks, he had sped past them. But the trailing bus was forced to stop. When the gunmen boarded and the passengers saw them, their hearts sank. It was the Taliban. The captives were brought to Banditimur, to the same clutch of villages that, when I'd visited earlier that year, had held only children or no one at all. For 3 days, the men were kept in a series of small houses as the Taliban decided their fate. Years later, I obtained an account of what happened as told by Rahim, a Taliban fighter. "When I went there," he said, "it was late evening, and all the passengers were there. They were yellow with worry." As he recalled it, Mullah Adam, the local commander, addressed the group. "When you were coming from Kabul to Kandahar, we received a credible report that you were coming to join the National Army. We have good sources." "What did you say we came for?" a captive asked. They could not believe it. They were simply in search of jobs in Iran, of a better life.
"Sons of Gulab Mangal!"
he shouted, referring to the Karzai-appointed governor of Helmand, the next province on the bus's route.
"You've come here to join the National Army and start fighting against us!"
The young men pleaded with Adam, swearing that they had never laid eyes upon Gulab Mangal and would never join the Afghan army. But he appeared unmoved. However, Rahim noticed doubt in his commander's eyes. Sure enough, Adam soon phoned Taliban leaders in Quetta, Pakistan, for advice, pointing out that some of the captives were clean-shaven,
like Americans.
He listened and then replied,
"Don't worry. We'll do our thing to them, and then you'll say, well done to us."
Adam turned to his fighters.
"Only one phone call remains. After that, we'll send these guys to hell."
In the meantime, the captives were kept in a series of huts, one of which Rahim was signed to guard. Sometime after midnight, he heard a commotion behind the door. He opened it and saw men crying. "What are you doing?"
"For God's sake, we are going to Iran for work. We've even paid money to traffickers. They are going to take us there."
"Keep quiet," Rahim said. If his commander heard them talking, they'd all be in trouble.
Another, heaving, cried out,
"My brother! I've got a little brother and 3 sisters. My mother and father are old. If something happens to me, what will they do?"
Doubt began to gnaw at Rahim. The next day, the crowd of Talibs had doubled. Rahim suggested to Adam that the men might indeed be innocent. Adam called the Taliban cleric in Pakistan and put the phone on speaker. High-ranking clerics typically decided matters of law and order of significant magnitude, and a busload of captives was one of the biggest abductions of the war so far.
I am sure the other scholars have informed you of their decision, but I wanted to hear it from you with my own ears, Audam said.
I was with the others when they made their decision, the voice said. Just go on and behead them.
Audam hung up and looked at Rahim.
This isn't my decision. It's the decision of all the scholars. Now do you agree?
Rahim asked how scholars sitting in Pakistan could possibly decide on issues here in Mewand, but Audam waved him off. The next morning, the captives were brought out in groups to a canal at the edge of the village. On their motorbikes, armed Taliban had gathered across the way. At once, the prisoners realized their fate. Some began wailing, some pleading for mercy. The young man to whom Rahim had spoken earlier was sobbing, calling out his parents' and siblings' names. Shots rang out. The cries grew louder. The Taliban kept firing. The bodies kept falling. Rahim couldn't bring himself to squeeze the trigger. Audam pulled up on his motorcycle.
What are you looking at? Shoot!
Rahim fired a shot haphazardly, and Audam cried,
No, Talib! You can do it!
He grabbed the gun and started firing himself, hitting one captive in the foot. The man lay moaning until Audam walked over and aimed two bullets at his head. After a while, there was no longer any noise, no wailing, no gunshots. Rahim crossed the canal. Lying there were the bodies of some of the captives, and nearby, four severed heads. 25 civilians in total died in the massacre, but incredibly enough, two managed to escape. One of them, Bashir, recounted his ordeal afterward to a reporter.
They tied our hands behind our backs. When they began firing at us, I ran.
The four others in his group were gunned down, but he escaped with a bullet in his leg.
I ran and hid, he said. When God Almighty wants to rescue a person, he can rescue them anywhere, under any circumstances.
News of the slaughter sparked a public outcry. The Taliban insisted they had received reliable reports that the victims were Afghan army recruits. Even when it became clear that there had not been a single enlistee among them, they held fast to this fiction. It was autumn 2008, and for the first time, anti-Taliban protests erupted countrywide. In villages that had rebelled against American and government abuses, the dark realization was setting that the Taliban were, in fact, no different from all the rest. Not far from the homes of the victims' families, on the grassy banks of the Alingar River, you can find a simple tarpaulin lash-up that serves as the home of a one-eyed man named Hazrat.
Nothing you see here in this country belongs to us, he told me when we first met. You see that road out there? That's not ours. Everything is borrowed, and everything can be taken back.
Hazrat was the malik of a village that no longer existed. Some 20 miles off to the west, Garloch had been a hamlet of poplar trees and irregular patches of wheat and barley, its few hundred straw and mud homes there since the time of Hazrat's grandfathers and his grandfather's grandfathers. The war had slipped into Garloch like a thief. One summer night in 2008, a Taliban commander from a nearby village showed up with his men and established a checkpoint. Before anyone realized it, they had become a fixture, though the people of Garloch had no vote in this. Not long thereafter, in a valley 10 miles away, insurgents ambushed a French patrol, killing 10 soldiers and wounding almost 24, France's biggest battlefield loss in a quarter century. American intelligence came to believe that one of the commanders involved, a man named Qadir, hailed from Garloch. 2 weeks passed. Then, early one morning, Hazrat awoke to a vibrating sky. Shelving shook in its place. Lights flashed outside. A friend arrived with news that the Americans had cordoned off the village. They were going house to house, blowing off gates and searching every room. Men and boys were being thrown to the ground, their hands tied behind their backs. The operation lasted 6 hours, after which the villagers watched soldiers board helicopters and fly off. Then an aircraft swooped in, dropping its payload on a house. Afterward, the government announced that the Americans had hit the house of Commander Qadir. When I suggested this to Hazrat as an explanation for the raid, he snorted.
You want to meet Kadir? I'll bring him right now.
He stepped outside and headed over to a row of tents, their blue UN-issued tarpaulins flapping in the breeze. He returned with a pole-thin old man, Haji Kadir, a village elder. Kadir explained that he had been hosting a wedding party at his home the night of the raid. The bomb had split his house in two, killing 16 guests, including 12 members of his family. Dozens were wounded. He walked me to his tent to show me his mementos from that day. A chalky white chunk of ceiling, a mangled sliver of metal railing, a smiling toddler, his eyes daubed with coal, his foot missing. The airstrike had targeted the wrong Kadir, though the Taliban commander did indeed live in the village and survived unscathed. Afterward, Hazrat, the village Malik, went to the governor of Lagman province and demanded an explanation. He was told that as long as the Taliban Kadir made Garloch his home, residents would not be able to allay American suspicions. Hazrat returned to his village and confronted Commander Kadir.
"Don't be a coward and hide among civilians," he told him. "If you want to fight Americans, go down south and leave us alone."
Eventually, Commander Kadir and a fellow insurgent departed. The troubles, Malik Hazrat told his grieving neighbors, were over. A month later, however, just after dawn, residents awoke to the same pulsating sky. Some farmers, already in their fields, watched as American helicopters alighted on the wheat farms abutting the village. The choppers fired at something unseen, and in a panic, villagers fled from their homes into the fields. What they did not know was that the U.S. forces were locked in a battle with Taliban insurgents in a nearby valley, and the fighting had spilled over to Garloch. In the havoc, two shepherds and a woman were gunned down. Warplanes then appeared overhead and bombed the village, destroying many homes. From then on, the whirling chop-chop of rotary blades in the middle of the night brought cold sweats and prayers. To some, the copters seemed almost magical.
"They wait in the sky, up there, behind those clouds," a boy told me. "When they want to attack, they drop like this."
He held his hand parallel to the ground, bringing it down in a rapid glide.
"There's nothing you can do."
2 months after the assault, the Americans returned yet again, acting on a tip that there were 100 anti-government militants in the area. Afterward, however, it was found that the only casualties were 200 dead sheep. Lagman Police Chief Abdul Karim Omaryar chalked up the incident to a NATO-led drive against terrorism, and a local news outlet ran the headline, "This time sheep mistaken as enemy combatants." The humor was lost on the inhabitants of Garloch, however, many of whom were herdsmen and saw their livelihoods vanish in a single night. They carried the eviscerated carcasses to the governor's house and deposited them in front of his gate in protest. Malik Hazrat also protested, to the media, to lawmakers, even to the president's office, and Karzai himself called to assure him that he had spoken to the Americans and that such tragedies would not be repeated. Hazrat returned home and once again promised his villagers they would be safe. A few weeks later, in the pre-morning dark, the Americans returned. As the soldiers approached a home, a dog growled and they shot it. A villager ran out, thinking a thief was on the premises, and they shot him too. His younger brother emerged with a gun and fired into the darkness, yelling for his neighbors. The soldiers shot him as well, and the barrage of bullets also hit his mother as she peered out a window. The soldiers then tied the three bodies together, dragged them into a room, and set off explosives. A pair of children stood watching, and they would later report the scene. An old man stepped out of the neighboring house holding an oil lamp. He was shot. His son ran out to help, and he too was shot. By night's end, 17 residents lay dead. When people came out of their houses to collect their loved ones, they found a body swinging from a tree. Some believed that the Americans were behind the hanging, while others guessed that it was a result of neighborhood retribution against whoever may have provided false intelligence. But no one could say for sure. U.S. officials announced that the dead were mostly militants, but villagers showed me photos of bloodied, lifeless women and old men. This time, Hazar and his people had had enough.
They descended upon the governor's house, burning President Obama in effigy. When the governor attempted to calm the crowd, protesters hurled stones at him. In the wake of the uproar, American authorities backtracked on their earlier claims. "I would say there was some potential that some of those killed were civilians," Colonel Greg Julian, a spokesman for U.S. forces, told a reporter, "because some of those men shooting at our troops may have been civilians." Subsequently, the United States paid $2,000 in compensation to each of the victims' families. Sitting with me in his tent, Hazrat railed, "That's what our lives are worth to you Americans? $2,000? You want to kill us and then pay to keep us quiet?" An old man nearby leaned forward and shouted, "My daughter is buried in the ground. You can give me every dollar on earth, but I won't touch it. It won't bring her back." Hazrat's eyes were burning. "When you go back to America, give Obama a message. You say you'll give us roads and schools? I don't give a shit about your roads and schools. I want safety for my family." After four deadly raids in the space of 5 months, Garloch residents faced a choice. They could take up arms in resistance, join the Taliban, and fight as their fathers had against a foreign occupation. But in this section of Lagman, haunted by the ghosts of Taliban brutality, resistance did not seem a viable option. Neither was neutrality, not in a war that had rendered the notion obsolete. So they took the only course remaining. They left. On foot, by car, by motorcycle, across an open country of crabgrass and gravel, they left. Across long, harsh miles, taking their clothes and their bedding and their animals, they left. Some did not quit until reaching Pakistan, but most, like Hazrat, stopped by the grassy riverbank near Lagman's main highway, far enough from trouble, but close enough to the world they knew, and erected a new village of tarpaulin and plastic. They called this canvas hamlet New Garloch, although it didn't feel much like home. Occasionally, someone felt the urge to return to the ghost town Garloch. Matiula, a young farmer, once made the trip, but upon arriving, he spotted a dog with its teeth clamped around the bones of a human hand. He promptly turned back. Life in New Garloch was hard going. Men and boys scavenged for food or cadged for UN handouts. Women were restricted to their tiny tents all day long. Every winter, a few children were buried. Quitting entirely and heading for Pakistan seemed more appealing by the season. But Malik Hazrat refused to leave. "I'll stay here until I can go home," he told me, "or until they bury me too." Mullah Manand and I were in a cramped hotel room in downtown Kandahar City. A queen-size bed occupied most of the room, but Manand insisted on sitting on the floor. Photographs of the Swiss Alps and Indian cricketers hung on the wall. A small white refrigerator hummed in one corner, and Manand stared at it for some time, as it was new to him. The air conditioner blasted frigid air, and the television silently played scenes of a Bollywood starlet frolicking in a flower bed. I asked him to describe his home village, and as he did, I used Google Earth to pull up its overhead image on my computer. "My God," he said, smiling. He shook his head in amazement. "I don't know how you're able to see that." He could not read or write, nor had he ever seen a map of any kind, but he grasped the picture's value at once. "America must be glorious," he said, not taking his eyes off the screen. "Maybe one day Afghanistan will become like that." It was summer 2010, and Manand now commanded nearly 100 men, a stature he hadn't experienced since his defeat by Jason Amerin. Yet he sat before me in nothing more than an old pattu and frayed sandals, carrying the Afghan equivalent of a few dollars. Money, in fact, was the abiding challenge. Scrounging together funds for ammunition or weapons had become part of life's daily struggle, and as his unit grew, the problem was only getting worse. "In the beginning, we had nothing," he said. "It was hard for us to even get batteries for our walkie-talkies. No one was helping us, just occasionally some rich people from the village who gave us donations. When we went on raids,
We divided the spoils, and I told my men, "Here, these are your expenses for the month. Use it to survive." We never called it a salary.
As the insurgency grew, funds began to trickle in to the Quetta-based Taliban leadership from private donors in the Gulf and merchants in Pakistan. Some of them were shunted to the movement's so-called district governors, who took a cut and dispersed what was left to field commanders like Manan.
They would tell us, "This money is just for weapons, just for walkie-talkies and daily expenses. It's not for personal use," he recalled.
While Karzai and the Americans could peddle influence through patronage, that is, by spending large sums of money, the Taliban was left to corral support mainly through sheer force. You stood in their way at your peril. Once, Manan's unit came into the possession of a list of NGOs operating in the area, and the amount of aid they were receiving for various projects. Manan noticed that, not far from his home, a businessman had obtained funds to repair a small community bridge.
"So we warned him," he recalled. "We used a trusted elder from the area. We did this so that if we acted, the elders wouldn't blame us. We told the elder to order the businessman to surrender his money to us and halt construction of the bridge."
If villagers wanted a bridge, Manan said, he'd use his money to build it. He simply couldn't allow the government or John Muhammad to take credit, not after everything that had happened, everything he'd been through. It would be the Taliban's way or none at all. In the developing system, Manan and other commanders would issue a warning to anyone caught working for the government or handling government money, a category that included aid workers, police officers, and most frequently of all, school teachers. Schools that had reopened their doors after 2001 were now again forced shut. Sometimes they were burned to the ground. Bridges, culverts, and irrigation ditches went unrepaired.
"Those who were warned and did not quit, we arrested," he said.
I asked what became of those he arrested.
"We had no option but the sword," he answered.
It occurred often enough, but it was the first time that he'd never forget. The man's name was Siddiqullah, and he had taken a job running a government checkpoint on the highway. Manan issued a warning, but Siddiqullah ignored it. With jobs scarce and families to feed, such defiance was not uncommon. Manan waited a few weeks, and then showed up at Siddiqullah's doorstep with dozens of men.
"Siddiqullah, son of Akram," he said in his wispy voice. "You've been told by our religious leaders to stop working for the government. Now you have no right to complain."
Siddiqullah started pleading. The men forced him into their jeep and drove out of the village. At a grassy escarpment, with the mountains looming, they ordered him out. Manan wanted it done quickly, before elders or family members had a chance to intervene. Once they became involved, things would get difficult. They made Siddiqullah sit by the stump of a large tree, and when he struggled, two of the men placed their weight on his arms and body and tied his hands behind his back. He began to scream, a deep madman's scream, and the talibs looked on and waited. One of them lowered a butcher's knife onto Siddiqullah's neck, as if measuring, and began to cut. It surprised Manan how long it took, how much work it was to decapitate a man. Afterward, when they tossed the head aside, it looked to him like a deflated balloon. I asked Manan if he'd ever done such a thing again. He looked at nothing in particular and appeared to think things over, as if it were some technical question or some subject that he had not considered until then, and answered in his shy and quiet voice,
"We were doing this too, maybe 3 times a month.
One night, Akbar Gul again awoke to a loud rumble. The sky outside was flashing white. Stepping into the street, he could smell burning rubber and smoke. He'd been staying with a friend, and the smoke appeared to be coming from the far side of the village, over by the mosque, not far from the direction of his house. He ran as fast as he could. His fears were quickly confirmed. A sizzling pit had swallowed his home's mud wall. The front yard was smoldering. His wife and daughter were inside.
"Please, God," he said to himself. "Please, God."
The door had been locked from the inside. He kicked with all his might,
kicked again, and finally it succumbed. He called out their names, and they came running, terrified but unharmed. After sunrise, he inspected the blast site. It betrayed all the telltale signs of explosives: an epicenter, a radical discharge of some sort, concentric circles of damage. The Americans had combed through the village only days earlier. He had been away on a mission, and he was sure that this was their doing. But how had they known which house was his? He spent the day investigating and came up empty. The only lead he had was a list of names of those seen chatting with soldiers on their patrol, which he'd collected from his scouts. Akbar Gul couldn't prove it, but he felt in his bones that one of the people on the list, a neighbor named Rakib, was the culprit. He never liked Rakib, who was always making excuses for not donating to the cause. The next morning, he showed up at Rakib's house with his men. "You're coming with me," he ordered.
"Why? What did I do?"
"This is over," he said, pointing to his damaged house down the street. "My wife and child were in there."
"What does this have to do with me?"
Akbar Gul said nothing, and the others forced Rakib into their truck. As they drove up the mountainside, Rakib started wailing. He had a wife and children at home, he pleaded. Akbar Gul ordered him out of the truck, put his Kalashnikov to Rakib's temple, and shot him dead. In general, informants were rare, although he'd heard stories of spies in other villages. Sometimes, when he drove his motorcycle along the rutted mountainside trails behind those villages, he came upon corpses dangling from trees. He tried not to think too much about them, instead spending his time dreaming up schemes to get himself funded. Those plans would get hashed out in his guest room, where he passed long hours with friends and fellow commanders, sipping cardamom tea and hacking into a spittoon. It was a room no simpler or grander than any other, with toshaks on the floor for sitting and an old tea-stained rug in the center. On the wall hung a picture, cut out from a magazine, of a crystal blue wave crashing onto a beach, and another of a giant red rose. Like many Pashtun men, Akbar Gul adored roses, their reds and pinks burning in a dun-colored world. When he wasn't working, he and his comrades would watch films of Taliban attacks on their cell phones, and when bored of those, clips of Bollywood movies. The Taliban's old injunctions against television and music had more or less fallen by the wayside. Back in the 1990s, Akbar Gul had embraced the Puritanism with fervor. He'd been Mullah Kabil, after all, enforcing the rules with his whip, because in a world turned upside down by civil war, where women could be dragged out of a home and dishonored in the open street, it seemed that the best medicine was to boil things down to their bare Islamic essentials. Anything that left the door open to sin was banned. Television, as a possible venue for pornography, had been high on that list. Now looking back, Akbar Gul could hardly recognize his old self or his old group. The commanders he knew in Wardak wore beards of differing lengths. Some, to avoid detection, even went clean-shaven. Nearly everyone he knew listened to music and traded cell phone video clips. And activities that he would have found abhorrent before, such as suicide bombing, now seemed a logical expression of religious faith and patriotic duty. Sometimes, when the group tired of watching movies, Saeed Mohammed, the only one among them with a religious education, would start up with his impromptu sermonizing. He would remind them that the Americans were on Afghan soil to convert the population to Christianity, to eradicate their way of life. To those present in the room, this explanation made perfect sense. They had all heard stories of the proliferation of brothels in Kabul, of U.S. soldiers flushing Qurans down the toilet. Saeed Mohammed was also an accomplished poet. Often he would conjure up verses on the spot, of unrequited love, of forbidden romance, of friendship, or of fear, the kind of fear that weighs upon you the first time you leave home to fight. Even on those slow afternoons, money was never far from Akbar Gul's thoughts. Fundraising proved to be a challenge no matter how well they did on the battlefield, so he began to diversify his approach. About a third of his operating expenses now came from donations, another third from various forms of coercion, such as the taxation of local construction firms, and the rest from Quetta. By 2008, he had also expanded into heroin trafficking, with policemen and government employees as his biggest customers. Through it all, Akbar Gul built himself the village equivalent of a mini-empire. Still, something was missing. It didn't feel like enough. For one thing, there was Ghulam Ali, the other top commander in Chak, who owned the only gas station for miles around. That brought in a steady revenue with which he attracted fighters and purchased weapons. One success begat another, and soon Ali was fielding one of the most formidable forces in the province, a development the Quetta leadership was quick to notice. He was appointed as Chak's district governor, usurping Akbar Gul, who was then awarded the sinecure of police chief. Akbar Gul never complained, but it ate away at him. He was sure that if he could command Ali-like profits, he'd run the Americans out of Wardak in no time. If anyone should be governor, it was he. Matters came to a head one afternoon in 2009 when he learned that Ghulam Ali was demanding that villagers stop paying taxes to the government for the operation of a community power station and instead hand the money over to the Taliban, specifically to him. In a meeting with greybeards and elders, Akbar Gul listened as they complained bitterly about the new policy. Then he asked them, "Under what authority does Ali want to take this money?"
"He says he wants it for jihad, for the sake of God."
"God?" he responded. "If you are fighting for God, God will provide everything for you." The men nodded in agreement. If Ali really wants the money, will he guarantee that the power station stays working? Will he pay the electricians to maintain it? Will he pay the station staff? Will he supply fuel for the generators? Where will he get that from? His mother? The men laughed. If the harvest is bad one year, will he keep things running like the government would? Akbar Gul was hardly one to defend the government under normal circumstances, but the idea of Ali lording it over his district was too much to bear.
"But there's nothing we can do," an elder replied. "You know he'll beat us if we refuse. Everyone is afraid of him."
Akbar Gul flashed with anger. "No, he's a dog. Ignore him. If he gives you any trouble, you tell me. I'm the commander here." Emboldened, the elders went to Ghulam Ali and announced that Akbar Gul had ordered them not to pay the tax. In a rage, Ali demanded a meeting, to which Akbar Gul immediately agreed. The elders were seated in a circle the next day, with Taliban commanders from around the district in attendance, when Akbar Gul strode in with his fighters. Ali was sitting with a few of his fighters, who wore bandanas to cover their faces.
"Are we meeting thieves or the Taliban?" Akbar Gul asked as he sat down.
"What is your problem?" Ghulam Ali snarled.
"You act like you're the king of Chak. Look at these poor people," he said, pointing to the elders. "You're making problems for them."
"You're making problems for my people," Ali snapped back. "You're telling these people to oppose my orders."
"Since when," he asked, "did a Taliban commander direct people to pay the government?
Maybe you love the Americans. Maybe you want to see the Taliban fail."
This was more than Akbar Gul could bear.
"No, I just want to fuck your wife," he said.
Ghulam Ali leapt up.
"Who do you think you are?"
"Who do you think you are?" Akbar Gul shot back.
"I'm the district governor of Chak, appointed by our leaders. I don't care if Mullah Omar himself appointed you. If you ever set foot in my village, I'll make you my bitch."
"Now let's see what happens," Ghulam Ali shouted back,
pounding a number into his phone and placing it on speaker. It was Mufti Abdul Latif, their immediate superior, speaking from his home in Peshawar, Pakistan. He was saying something, but Akbar Gul, clouded over with rage, could not stand to listen and stormed out. Later that evening, he received a phone call from Mufti Latif. He was to report to Peshawar immediately. The dust kicking up from Peshawar's streets seemed thicker than usual, made all the worse by the humid summer air. It reminded Akbar Gul of just how much he despised Pakistan, particularly its weather. A war was raging here now between militants, who also called themselves Taliban, though they had little to do with his movement, and the Pakistani government. He wondered how anyone could actually fight in such wet heat. It had taken him almost 2 days to reach the city, as he'd used a circuitous route in order to avoid the main highway. As soon as he arrived, he borrowed a cell phone from a pedestrian and dialed Mulla Latif, who dispatched a car to pick him up. He stood on the street, watching auto rickshaws and motorbikes scoot by, some of them carrying women in burqas and headscarves, and a few even with their hair as naked as when they'd risen that morning. A black Land Cruiser pulled up. A man leaned out the window. "Are you Akbar Ghul?" He nodded and climbed into the back seat, where two others were already seated. Another man sitting in the front turned to greet him and then held up a black hood. "I'm sorry, but rules are rules," he said. Before Akbar Ghul could react, a hood was forced onto his head and he felt the weight of two men on top of him. When he tried to cry out, his voice was muffled. He couldn't believe what was happening. He lay struggling for air, cursing himself for his bravado, bargaining with God that he'd change his ways. No one spoke, and he could hear horns and street vendors outside. After some time, those too faded away. The car was moving fast now, very fast, out on the open highway somewhere. An hour passed. He felt the vehicle turn and halt. A horn blared. Something, maybe a gate, squeaked open. Then a handler removed his hood, and he sat there, gasping for air and looking around. He was in the driveway of a large country house, surrounded by towering cement walls. Mountains were peeking over in the distance. He was led into the compound. Standing in the hallway, arms folded, was Mufti Abdul Latif. For a moment, everyone was silent. Then Latif broke into a wide grin.
"You crazy troublemaker! What kind of problems are you making for us out there?"
He laughed and embraced his old friend. The two sat down to dinner, talking about their families and the latest news of the war. Afterward, Latif suggested that Akbar Ghul catch some rest. Around 1 in the morning, Latif woke him up.
"Time to go. Everyone is waiting."
A white Toyota Town Ace minivan stood outside in the darkness, curtains drawn over its side windows. Latif motioned Akbar Ghul to climb into the tiny space behind the back window and the rearmost seats. No one spoke during the journey. After about 30 minutes, they arrived at a house even larger than the previous one and made their way down to a long, brightly lit hall, finally entering a room near the end. There was no furniture or even rugs, only a glaring white fluorescent light set in the ceiling. After a few minutes, another door swung open, and Taliban commanders, whom Akbar Ghul recognized from Wardak, streamed in. Sometime later, religious clerics entered. Then Ghulam Ali himself strode in. They all sat wordlessly, sipping tea and playing with their phones. Akbar Ghul realized that they were waiting for someone. Nearly an hour had gone by when he appeared. He wore a crisp, cream-colored salwar, more perfectly tailored than any Akbar Ghul had ever laid eyes on. He had large, tired, puffy eyes and was beardless, with a close-cropped mustache and a crew cut. Akbar Ghul knew immediately that he was in the presence of Pakistani intelligence. "So this is what they look like," he thought to himself. Growing up in Afghanistan, you'd hear about the shadowy Inter-Services Intelligence, or ISI, spoken of the way people spoke of malevolent jinns, omnipresent and responsible for the ills of the world. Few had ever seen an operative in the flesh.
"We have a problem in Wardak," the man began, "and we're here to solve it."
He looked around the room.
"We need to appoint some new people. So which one of you is Akbar Ghul?"
He raised his hand.
"Ah, I should have guessed. You look like the kind of guy that likes to argue."
Akbar Ghul smiled his most disarming smile and said, "No, I'm not like that.
So tell me, why do you create problems for Ghulam Ali? Why don't you let him do his job and you do yours?"
Akbar Ghul resented this tone. Who was he, hundreds of miles from the battlefield, to question him?
"Let me ask you something first, if you don't mind,"
Akbar Ghul said, as Mufti Latif pinched his leg.
"Why do you help America? You take their money and work with them? Then you work with us as well. What kind of business is this?"
Everyone was quiet. Finally, the ISI officer said,
"Go on, I am listening."
"Well, let me start with a joke. People talk about overpopulation on Earth and having too many people, but I don't see the big problem. He paused. You see, some people are actually just jackasses. He pointed to Ghulam Ali, and we don't have to worry about including donkeys in the count. The agent burst out laughing. A few of the others giggled. Look, in my area I have support. I don't want this power plant to become useless. That's what this is all about. The agent turned to Ghulam Ali. Let's say the Americans are on patrol, and you want to plan an ambush. What do you do? Ghulam Ali thought about it and then answered, I just grab my guys, however many I need, and we attack. We are brave. The agent turned to Akbar Ghul. And you? Well, first I'll watch them, the Americans. I'll position my guys ahead of them, between them and their base. We'll watch, sometimes for an hour. Sometimes we'll mine their escape route. And when I feel the time is right, and I'm sure that my guys can escape alive, I'll order them to fire. The agent nodded and stood up. Thanks for your time. We're done here. He turned to Akbar Ghul. I don't have answers to your questions right now, but I'll send them to you. Mufti Latif and Akbar Ghul were escorted back to their vehicle. The sun was breaking through the morning fog, and they could hear the call to prayer. They were blindfolded and driven back to Peshawar. The following day, Akbar Ghul returned to Afghanistan to learn that Ghulam Ali had been ordered to abandon his power plant scheme. Mufti Latif also passed along the message that Akbar Ghul was expected to be more of a team player, to not lose sight of the mission. He never did receive those answers, however. Akbar Ghul knew that this was how things worked in his country. Pakistan had long been the eminence grise of Afghan politics, stemming from a generations-old rivalry between the two neighbors. Tensions had reached a fevered pitch in the 1970s when Afghan dictator Daud Khan attempted to whip up nationalist fervor among millions of Pashtuns living in Pakistan for a united Pashtunistan, a Pashtun homeland that would straddle both sides of the border and necessarily implied the breakup of Pakistan. Khan also harbored separatist insurgents looking to make the Pakistani province of Balochistan into an independent state. Islamabad had retaliated in kind, supporting Islamist rebels, precursors to the Mujahideen, in Afghanistan. It might have remained little more than a simmering neighborhood rivalry if not for the Soviet invasion and the U.S. proxy war, which, through billions of dollars in aid and military equipment, helped assure the rise of the ISI as a formidable player in regional politics. In the 1990s, the Pakistanis had backed the Taliban, only to abandon them after the U.S. invasion, appearing ready to at least tolerate the new Afghan order. It was soon clear, however, that Karzai and the Northern Alliance were too closely linked to India for Pakistan's comfort. When the Taliban revived itself, the ISI threw its support behind the insurgency, even as it publicly proclaimed support for the U.S. mission. Pakistan could bring pressure to bear on the Taliban at any moment. In 2010, for example, it arrested a number of leading Taliban figures on suspicion they had contacted the Afghan government to explore possible future peace talks. To Akbar Ghul, it all seemed like a big, scandalous game. One group of Taliban commanders in Wardak were known ISI favorites, regularly reporting to their handlers in Pakistan. A second group maintained subterranean links with the Afghan government, an insurance policy if the going got too tough. The unfortunate ones, and he counted himself in this last category, floated between these two poles, working for whoever could keep the guns and money flowing. Through it all, Ghulam Ali's stature continued to grow. Akbar Ghul watched, as over the months, alliances shifted and three of Chak's top seven commanders fell under Ali's influence. He complained to Mufti Latif, but there was little that Latif or the ISI could do, for Ali was undeniably effective and had the ear of top figures in Quetta. So Akbar Ghul requested a meeting with the leadership. Connecting with a member of the so-called Quetta Shura face-to-face was difficult, if not impossible, without access, and there were no Wardakis on the Grand Council. Still, Akbar Ghul knew of a Quetta-based Talib named Rahmatullah, who hailed from Chalk and had some links to the senior leadership, so he decided to make the trip to Pakistan to see him. He set out in a shared minivan taxi, stopping overnight at a hotel in Ghazni City, where he spent a sleepless night thinking about Haji Mullah, a Taliban commander he knew who had upset the leadership and simply disappeared after a Quetta meeting. The following day, he arrived in the border town of Chaman and hopped into another shared taxi. He was about an hour into Pakistan when they encountered a checkpoint. A Pakistani policeman peered through the window and motioned for him to step out. They spent 20 minutes there at the roadside negotiating the bribe. It was early evening when he arrived in a Pashtun quarter of Quetta, filled with men in turbans and beards like his own, some carrying walkie-talkies and others driving brand new SUVs, and still others loitering outside mosques, talking. He dialed Rahmatullah. Late that night, he was brought by rickshaw to a small house and led to an underground bunker of some sort. Opening the door, he found six or seven men seated on tushaks. He greeted Rahmatullah and then the others in turn. Two of them he recognized as commanders from his province, but the others he could not place, though judging by their accents, they hailed from Kandahar or Chaman. Rahmatullah did most of the talking while the Kandaharis sat watching. Finally, one of them, the most heavy-set, disheveled-looking of the lot, spoke up.
"Tell me, are you in this for jihad or for your country? Do you love all Muslims or just your people in Wardak or in Afghanistan?"
It seemed like a trick question to Akbar Gul. He was there to complain about Ghulam Ali, but somehow this had become about him.
"I love jihad and my people. It's the same."
The Kandahari continued to grill him with such logical puzzles and riddles.
"Do you believe that educated people or uneducated people know best?"
"Educated, of course. I am illiterate and you are educated. That's why I've come to you."
"And if I order you to do something you disagreed with, what would you do?"
Akbar Gul squirmed and gave a half-hearted answer, and the interrogation continued. He desperately wanted out. Finally, he offered a compromise.
"If you want me to work with Ghulam Ali, I'll do it. Just please don't ask me to work under him. We're more effective together as one."
The men nodded and seemed pleased. Eventually, food arrived. It was the most sumptuous meal he'd had in some time, plate after plate of meatballs and sweet rice pudding for dessert. They sat and talked long into the night, about war and friendship and poetry. They spoke of the good things in life and how those things were gone forever. They talked until dawn, and when the men rose to leave, Akbar Gul embraced each of them in turn. He told them,
"I'm a loyal guy. I'll do whatever it takes. If you want me to put a bomb in a crowded market, if you say that's the right thing to do, I'll do it."
He spent the next day touring the Taliban infrastructure in Quetta with Rahmatullah, visiting mosques to speak with scholars and bazaars to speak with important benefactors of the movement. In the evening, he was taken to one of Rahmatullah's madrasas, where hundreds of skull-capped boys sat in a chain of rooms, reciting from the Quran and writing on chalkboards.
"These are my little warriors," Rahmatullah said proudly.
Akbar Gul could hardly believe what he was seeing, but he told Rahmatullah that it was good these boys were being taught to fight for their country and their religion. Rahmatullah smiled and replied that it was difficult to raise them this way, but necessary. Before Akbar Gul boarded a taxi back to the Afghan border, Rahmatullah promised him that he'd keep an eye on Ghulam Ali and see that he didn't grow too strong, and that he'd talk to the leadership about finding Akbar Gul more funds. The summer of 2009 saw an increase in infighting among Wardak's Taliban and growing tensions with their co-insurgent allies in Hekmatyar's faction. At the same time, because the Taliban leadership paid units a bonus for outstanding attacks, the number of fake assaults, staged for video, surged. Akbar Gul played the game as well as anyone, but as the days went on, he slid into despair. He hated those men in Quetta. He hated the ISI. And most of all, he hated Ghulam Ali and his success. But he kept it all to himself. It was a dangerous new world, and you couldn't trust anyone, even your own allies. Countrywide,
his movement was losing steam. The Taliban were now responsible for more civilian deaths than were the Americans. In some communities, roadside bombs, assassinations, and summary executions had come to take their place alongside Guantanamo and the door-kicking night raids of U.S. troops in the pantheon of fears that kept villagers awake at night. Meanwhile, the insurgency was spreading from marginalized cut-off communities into those that had fared better in the post-2001 years, whether it was welcomed there or not. In Chak, many of the commanders Akbar Gul knew had been killed in night raids, leaving Ghulam Ali's crew and a smattering of independents, most younger than he, with no memories of the old Taliban days. It became increasingly difficult to defend their actions, which included in one case beheading a schoolteacher, to the village elders. He turned inward, planning operations on his own, without other commanders, and keeping away from Pakistan. Then, one day, he received a surprising phone call. It was the government's new chief of police for Chak, an old war buddy from his Hizbi Islami days. They had ended up on opposite sides through chance more than anything else. The man spoke of a government program that invited fighters to switch sides in return for money and a guaranteed job. Akbar Gul listened and wondered where such a program had been years earlier, when he would have given anything for a normal life. But things were different now, more complicated. He realized that it had been a long while since the Taliban meant anything to him. But he couldn't imagine himself openly joining forces with the government either. In fact, he knew that friends who had gone down that route were languishing in a dangerous political no-man's land. Karzai's government had not fulfilled its promises, and for the Taliban, they were now marked men. "What are you fighting for? The Americans are going to leave anyway," the police chief said. "We are building Afghanistan." The Taliban, he added, were terrorists, enemies of the country, stooges of Pakistan. Akbar Gul was unmoved. "There are no good men among the living, and no bad ones among the dead," he replied, reiterating one of his favorite Pashtun proverbs. This war had left no group, Afghan or foreign, with clean hands. You had to be careful to survive. Today, the government said the Taliban were terrorists, but what about tomorrow? Would the Taliban be venerated, as the Mujahideen were now venerated? Would the Americans change their allegiances, as it seemed they had done after the 1980s, and brand the Karzai government as their enemy? It was too much for Akbar Gul to grapple with just then. He knew only that to trust the categories put forth by the Americans or the government was to go down the road to ruin. He told the police chief that he wasn't interested. He said he was satisfied with his life as it was, thanked him for his call, and hung up. The next morning, with new presidential elections looming, with American patrols crawling here and there, with Taliban groups erecting their usual checkpoints to hunt for spies and possible kidnap targets, he hopped on his motorcycle, headed for the low hills behind the village, and began another day of work.